And then Psalm 3 is for you. I should say the Psalms are for you. Beginning in verse 1, the Psalm of David as he fled from his son Absalom. Lord, how they have increased who trouble me. Many are they who rise up against me. Many are they who say of me, there is no help for him in God. Selah. Now, let me say that no one really knows what Selah means, okay? It's been said that it is a poetical pause, that it is a musical interlude. Some have said that it's actually not a time of slowing down, but it's a crescendo, a building, a time of building up. I wouldn't say one way or the other what I would say adamantly, but I personally prefer a pause for meditation. A pause for meditation. Verse 3. But you, O Lord, are a shield for me, my glory, and the one who lifts up my head. I cried to the Lord with my voice, and he heard me from his holy hill, Selah. I lay down and slept. I awoke, for the Lord sustained me. I will not be afraid of 10,000s of people who have set themselves against me all around. Arise, O Lord, save me, O my God, for you have struck all my enemies on the cheekbone. You have broken the teeth of the ungodly. Salvation belongs to the Lord. Your blessing is upon your people. Selah. All men are like grass, and all their glory is like the flowers of the field. Amen. Please be seated. It is really a very sad set of circumstances. Absalom, David's son, his dear son, the one that he loved so much, has rebelled. He has led this coup, and he has driven his father from the throne. He has driven him from the capital city of Jerusalem, and he has driven him out into the wilderness. If you want to jot it down, if you want to read it for yourself, it's recorded in 2 Samuel chapter 15, beginning at verse 13 and the verses that follow there. But I want to begin, if we're following the outline of the bulletin, it would say introduction, and actually should say under that the context. And I want us to consider the multitude of problems that David is encountering when he writes this psalm. I want you to see the load that this man after God's own heart, mind you, is carrying. The first thing, I'm going to mention four, but the first would be that there is this personal grief on the part of David just knowing his son's rebellion. Right? We understand because we have seen, or we know the rest of the story. We know that this coup is eventually going to be put down. We know that David is going to be the victor. We know that actually Absalom is going to die. And you remember the story that when the messenger came in to tell David, the king, what had happened on the battlefield, and David asked the messenger, is the young man Absalom safe? And then that's when the messenger says to the king, may the enemies of my lord the king and all who rise against you to do harm be like that young man. And do you remember David's response? It was like it just shook him to the core. He tore his robes. He wept bitterly. And he cries out, my son Absalom, oh my son Absalom, if I had only died in your place. And he says, my son, Absalom. That's a picture into David's heart. David had a very, very tender heart. And we see his tenderness even toward his crass, rebellious son. Some of you parents know that kind of love. You know the kind of love that only a parent can give their child, even when they're in the midst of rebellion. Rebellion against the family name, you might say, an errant child. That's the kind of love that David had for his son. And then not only does his heart know that grief because of what his son has done, but there was also the disloyalty of his counselors, his generals, his officials. These were men that he was close to. These were men that David loved. These were men that David had given to so much. He had taken a risk in putting some of these men into the position on the cabinet to which he had placed them. Some of you have employees, and you may say, you know, I'm good to my people. I'm good to those that work for me. I take care of them. That's the way that David would have been with his employees, those that were under him and served him. Some of them were his confidants. But now they had rebelled as well. They had gone to the side of Absalom. Don't you know that broke David's tender heart? And then, thirdly, there would have been the rumors. We know that because they're hinted at in verse 2 of this psalm. But you know that the people would have remembered Saul. They would have remembered that Saul was a man who was very gifted, a very gifted leader. Here was a man anointed by God. Saul was even considered one of the prophets of God. But then there came a time when God withdrew his spirit from Saul. Saul didn't have saving grace. And God took his spirit away from Saul, and Saul hardened his heart toward God. And the people, the rumors were, well, that's just what's happened to David. Same thing. It's as if they were saying, I told you what was going to happen. The same thing that happened to Saul, now God has taken his spirit away from our king, David. And then, not only so, but fortunately, there was the sad shape of affairs in Israel. How David loved Israel. And now to see his beloved country so vulnerable to attacks from enemies on all sides, and not only so, but to see the commander-in-chief himself suffering this humiliation, and it wasn't just personal humiliation, it was public humiliation. His son Absalom, having run him from the throne. And he was a mockery to the family. He was violating the women on the rooftops. And you know everybody knew what David himself had done with Bathsheba. Most, if not all, had known what David had done with her husband, Uriah. Public, utter public shame. Public humiliation. And the people again are saying, you know, I told you, it's God's punishment. God is punishing David for his sins. And all that talk about all of that talk about his religion, it's all a farce. So that is the context in which David sits down with his pen and begins to write Psalm 3. And he writes it for himself, and he writes it for the people of Israel. He writes it for you and for me. I want you to see first the number of his enemies. He mentions it in verse 1. He says, Lord, how they have increased who trouble me. Many are they who rise up against me. And the truth is, they are many. And David is few. He is the minority, and the minority is shrinking, and the revolution is growing. The rumor is, in fact, that David is dead, and the momentum is, long live King Absalom. You better get your political contributions into King Absalom, because he's the man on the block. You know, he's the man handing out the favors. If you look closely enough, which I want you to do, be looking at verses 1 and 2, just look at them as I say this. If you really look closely enough, see if you agree with me, it's not the enemies that really have David perplexed. It's not really their strength or their words or their rebellion. That's not really what vexed David's soul. Can you see what it is? I think his greatest fear was this. Could it be that what they're saying is true? Could it be that God really has abandoned me? Could it be, as he says in verse 4, or verse 2, could it be that there truly is no help for me in God? You see, David's conscience is smitten. In essence, David is saying, I was wrong. I was wrong to sin with Bathsheba. I was wrong to have her husband killed. And everybody knows it. I've been caught red-handed. Everybody knows my sin. They know, as well as I do, that God has every reason to abandon me. Could it be that I really have been forsaken? You see, David is under the disciplinary hand of God in this psalm, and he feels as if God has abandoned him. Have you ever been there? Have you ever known the disciplinary hand of your Father in heaven and thought that perhaps he has abandoned me for good? This time, for sure, I'm never going to be close to God again. Now, first of all, let me say this. It's a good thing that David's conscience was smitten. He was wrong. He had sinned. Had his conscience not been smitten, that would be reason to fear. But the simple fact that his conscience was smitten, you might say that was partial proof that God had not abandoned him. So in that sense, it's a good thing. But secondly, I want you to learn this. I want you to mark it in your heart, perhaps even write it down, that God-mandated affliction is a reality for God's children. God-mandated affliction is a reality for anyone who is a genuine believer, a genuine child of God. You will suffer affliction by the hand of God. God abandonment or God desertion is an impossibility. God abandonment is not feasible. It just will not happen. It cannot happen. I'm going to tell you why in just a minute. But let me ask you to think about your own life. Let's say that there is a sin in your life, and that is something that you have fought, possibly you fought it for many, many years. And you've had some success in dealing with this sin. It's lied dormant in your life. And then all of a sudden, out of nowhere, comes this temptation, and then you give in to the temptation, and you have done it again. And here comes the struggle. You know, here comes the guilt and the lack of peace and perhaps even the tears. And they're not tears of sorrow this time. Perhaps they're tears of fear. Because you're thinking what I alluded to just a moment ago. God is not going to have anything to do with me now. And you may even think that God is saying to you, you know, if I've heard you say this once, I've heard you say it 1,000 times, I'll never commit this sin again. And lo and behold, you've done it again. And it's as if you think God is saying, well, this time, I'm out of here. I'm leaving you. I want you to notice, brethren, that this psalm is more about David's Lord than it is about David himself. You need to know that the only one of God's children, there's only been one child of God that's ever been abandoned. There's only been one child of God that was ever utterly deserted by God, and that was God's Son, Jesus Christ. When He hung on the cross, He hung there, the condemned criminal. The darkness fell, and when the darkness fell, God turned His face away from His Son. The comfortable presence of God was stripped away from His Son. He knew what it was to be utterly forsaken. He knew what it was to be totally abandoned. He knew what it was to be painfully deserted. All of the above, so that you never, ever have to know that abandonment. He cried, my God, why hast thou forsaken me? So that you never, ever have to make that your cry. You never have to make that your own prayer. Brethren, we never get what we deserve. Not one of us has ever, as a genuine believer, ever been totally abandoned by God. You've never once been utterly left alone. Not one time. And what an affront it is to God's glory, to Jesus' glory, to Jesus' sacrifice even, that when we find ourselves walking in the valley, when we find ourselves lost, we've lost our way in the wilderness, to ever say, to ever let it even cross our minds that we have no help in God. Because it's never, ever true. And David is our model. Conscience stricken, he throws himself on God's mercy. Afflicted, he throws himself on God's faithfulness. And when everybody else says, David, you've been forsaken. Notice what David says in verse 3, but you, O Lord, are a shield for me, my glory, and the one who lifts up my head. I cried to the Lord with my voice, and He heard me from His holy hill. You see, there's nothing, not one thing that keeps David from going to God in prayer. Not one thing. Not the words of the accuser as he whispers in David's ear, you know, David, you have really messed up now. God will never have anything to do with you again. Not even the words of his enemies, not the desertion of his friends, not the abject poverty of the situation, not his guilt, not his feelings, not his lethargy, not any of that, not even the pain. Nothing keeps David from going to God in prayer. I want you to know that is a very, very unnatural thing. But do you know that's the mark of a man of prayer? It's the mark of a woman of prayer, a child of prayer. Men, women, and children of prayer are very abnormal because they pray when nobody else will pray. They pray when it's very unnatural to pray. They pray when everybody else says that there's no reason to pray. They don't even care about prayer. The man of prayer is praying. When the man of prayer is afflicted, when he feels like he's been abandoned not only by his friends, not only by his family, but he feels that even God has abandoned him, you know where you find the man of prayer? On his face. When all hell has put its forces against the man or the woman or the child of prayer, you know where you find that person? Prostrate before God. pouring out their hearts before God, pouring out their heart before this God of mercy, before His throne of mercy, clinging to Him in a time of need, even when it doesn't feel like they should, even when they feel that God is so far from them. They fall down on their face before Him. Why is it that we don't do that more? What is it that hinders us from throwing ourselves at God in hard times? Or what about the good times? I don't know when I pray less. When I'm in the midst of a trial, or when everything is just a bed of roses, I'm so happy. I think that may be when I pray less. Let me give you a few things that might be a list of reasons we don't pray, or things that hinder our prayer life. One is we don't think prayer works. This goes back to what we said last week. It may be that God has said no, and you wanted Him to say yes. And so therefore you think, well, God doesn't answer my prayers. He didn't do what I asked Him to do. And so why should I pray? Another reason is that we're just so blasted impatient. Let me remind you of the Moravians who prayed for 100 years for revival. They prayed 100 years for God to do a great work. And finally He did. But they waited 4 generations before God acted on their prayers. It may be a hindrance in your life to pray because you're just not in the habit of praying. If you're not in the habit of praying in the good times, in the normal time, the normal walk with God, everyday walk with God, then why do you think you're going to be able to pray in the hard times? And so you need to develop the prayer life, develop a habit of prayer. It may be that we just don't believe in the reality of His presence. It may be that we are going through a hard time, or we've sinned and we know we've really messed up, and so we feel that we're not worthy of His presence. Let me remind you of this context of this psalm. David is in the wilderness. The ark of the covenant, which symbolized the presence of God, was in the capital city of Jerusalem. And yet David continues to pray. He perseveres in prayer. He pours out his heart to God. And that is our model. It's a model to us in the new covenant that we enjoy, an even greater promise that David didn't even know. And that is when Jesus said, "Lo, I am with you always." He's with you always, even to the end of the age. If Jesus were sitting next to you tonight, would you talk to Him? Would you feel that you would be able to do that? Despite your circumstances, despite the hard times, despite some sin in your life, unconfessed, unrepentant, and yet He's sitting right next to you, would you be able to say something to Him? He is sitting next to you. He is in this place. I'm sure you'd be able to say something to Him. And you'd be able to do it because of His promises to you. David goes to God and he cries for deliverance. The result is refuge, so much so that even when he was stricken in his conscience and he has this fearful soul, David is able to lie down and sleep. And when he awakens again, you know what? He's not afraid anymore. Look at verse 5. It says, "I lay down and slept. I awoke, for the Lord sustained me. I will not be afraid of 10,000s of people who have set themselves against me all around." Dr. Robert Rayburn, the late president of Covenant Seminary, served as a chaplain in World War II. He actually saw combat in the European theater. After the war, he became the minister of the Collegiate Church at Wheaton, and he stayed in the reserves. He was inactive, but he was in the reserves, and the Korean conflict broke out, and he was called to Korea. He said it was really a shock that he was sitting there in his church and doing his business, doing his work, and a letter came and said, "You're to report for duty. You're to report for your physical." He went to his physical, and next thing he knew, he was in active duty in Korea. And the first meeting, when they were handing out the assignments, One of the chief chaplain went to the 8 chaplains and said, I need a volunteer because we need somebody to go in to parachute in behind enemy lines. And Dr. Rayburn, the way he said it was, there were 7 good excuses. And it was left to him. He never parachuted before. He was assured that he would be given 6 or 7 weeks of training. And it wasn't many days after they'd been given their assignments that the head chaplain came to him and said, Bob, the situation's very grave and we've got to send you in very soon. And your first jump will be behind enemy lines at night. And he was absolutely mortified, and the time came, they loaded the troops into the troop carrying plane, and said he was shaking like a leaf. He thought, here I am, I'm trying so hard, I need to be a witness to these men, they're looking to me to be an example, and I'm scared to death and I'm going to get killed in the process. And he said he prayed and he prayed and he prayed, and God was giving him many, many verses out of the Psalms. And he said the last thing he remembered on that plane was praying, God, help me to be a witness to these men, and he fell fast asleep. And he slept for 2 hours. And the only thing that woke him up was the commander of the flight saying, Bob, it's time to jump. And he did so. He was the only one of the troops that landed on the ground. Everybody else landed under enemy fire in the river. And chaplains carried pistols in the Korean conflict. And he was, with his one pistol, was able to cover the other men as they made it back to shore. That's what God does. God gave Dr. Rayburn this peace, not only so he could bear witness to those that were around him, but even allowed him to sleep, even though he was surrounded by his enemies. That's what God does for the Christian. If you are a child of God, then you know His peace. If you've never given your life to Christ, then you don't know that peace. In fact, I would say you should be a very unpeaceful, non-peaceful person. You should be a very uneasy person. I don't see how you would ever sleep at night. Because not only do you face the trials of this life alone, but you actually face the judgment of God without an advocate. Dr. Rayburn had an advocate. David had an advocate. You can have an advocate as well, so much so that when you are in trouble in the storms of life, you can go to God through the advocate, and He's always there for you. Lastly, let me point out from verses 7 and 8 that this man became very secure amidst his foes. Not only does he cry out for deliverance and then get deliverance, he breaks out into song in verse 7, Arise, O Lord, save me, O my God. For you have struck all my enemies on the cheekbone. You have broken the teeth of the ungodly. Do you notice in verse 7 that he speaks in past tense? He says, you have struck all my enemies. David is talking about victory as if he's so certain of it. He speaks of it as if it has already happened. Now you need to understand too, David is talking about ultimate victory. This is ultimate rejoicing. He's not rejoicing simply because God gave him refuge. Please understand, it's kind of tricky, but please understand that. He is not rejoicing simply because God gave him shelter. He is rejoicing because God will give him ultimate victory. Understand, he's the king of Israel. For him to say that I'm rejoicing in ultimate victory when the civil war is still going on would be like admitting defeat. He is not going to be satisfied, you might say. His triumph would not be complete until he is on the throne again in the capital city in Jerusalem, because he is the king of Israel. Now please understand that our troubles, your troubles and my troubles, are just nothing compared to David's troubles. If we were to put our troubles side by side with David's struggles in this psalm, ours would pale in comparison. But hear me say this. Our triumph is so much greater than David's triumph, what he's talking about, what he would have known as triumph as the king of Israel. To put his triumph next to our triumph, his triumph would pale in comparison. Do you understand that? Do you know that? Do you live in that kind of confidence in God? That your victory is so certain that it's in past tense. We talked about this before in Revelation 22, that not only one day will Jesus reign, but we will reign with Him. We die with Him, we are raised with Him, and one day we will reign with Him forever and ever and ever. We suffer, we share Christ's sufferings on this earth, we will share in His exaltation in heaven, and it is so certain that it's as if it has already happened. It is so certain. That's why Paul talks about it in past tense in Romans 8 when he says, whom He justified, these He also glorified. It's so certain, it's as if it's already happened. Heaven is not merely a refuge. Do you understand that? Heaven is not merely a refuge. Heaven is the promised place of triumph, ultimate victory. And we should live that way. We wake up in the morning, we go to work on a Monday morning, we live in that kind of victory. That heaven is a certainty for me one day. It's like the meditation upon entering the sanctuary. Oh, for grace to see our future glory amid present shame. Let me ask you to bow your heads, and I'll have just a word before I pray, but please bow your heads. And let me say a word to the believer. If you're a believer here tonight, there is no affliction in your life that you undergo that is meaningless. Not one thing in your life is trivial. Not one thing. If you, however, tonight or outside of Jesus Christ, then let me inform you, there is no meaning in your affliction. What it is you're going through in your life has no meaning except separation from God, except punishment for sin. And if you want to find refuge from meaninglessness, there's only one place, and it is salvation in the Lord. As our psalm, verse 8 says, salvation is of the Lord. The brethren, that is worthy of a Selah. It's worthy of a pause to meditate on the divine, discriminating, distinguishing, eternal, infinite, immutable love of God. And I say, pause my soul right now and think about this right now. Our God, we pray that we would be drawn to Christ through Your Word, through this psalm tonight. We pray that we would be lifted up out of our affliction, whatever it may be, for each individual here. And we know, we say, we will give You all the praise and all the glory for Jesus' sake. Amen.